Okay, well, the first self proposal on cosmological phase transitions. This is work done mostly at the University of Maryland, and I must say, mostly by the first two authors, Greg Stevens and Steve Ramsey, with, I don't know, some help or encumbrance from Baylakoo and myself. So I'm very glad that Greg is here, and he sure helped me out with the questions. So what's the issue? Essentially, in a nutshell, the idea is, well, this proposal by Zurek in 1985 about what is the effect of the non-equilibrium aspect in the density of defects created in a second order phase transition. There was a traditional way of doing it, which I'm going to mention in a few minutes, whose general prediction was that the creation of defects was very inefficient. Then Zurek in 85 made a new proposal that emphasized the non-equilibrium aspects of the problem, which has the consequence that it made the process to look much more efficient. And that called attention to a lot of people. There were actually a flurry of activity trying to detect experimentally these defects, and they were successful. But not to the point of getting a precise check, quantitative detailed check of the actual proposal. They were successful to the point that they showed that actually the defects are formed in an efficient way, but not to the point that they were able to tell us whether Zurek was right or wrong. So essentially the aim of this work is trying to get a little closer to that answer. I mean, I'm not going to give you the answer, but I think this work gets a little closer to whether the 1985 proposal, the Friesel proposal, is right or wrong. And, well, you're going to see the data and you will be able to get your own conclusions. My personal conclusions is that we are inching towards the yes, that our data support the Friesel conjecture. So, now this is just standard, it's just to establish the language. The phase transition.
When you say data, you mean numerical data or experimental actual?
No, the numerical data for our simulation.
The workshop is so far uncontaminated by experiments.
Thank God. Let's keep it that way. So, okay, in a phase transition with symmetry breaking, a formally equilibrium state becomes unstable, but sometimes there is a transition to new stable states, but sometimes the transition gets frustrated. There are parts of the system which are trapped into the old state, and those are, if they are topologically stable, and we are going to call that the defects of the theory, and the typical examples are vortexes in superfluids and superconductors. So this is the usual picture. I did have a picture somewhere. So there is an effective potential or something which in a high temperature state is just the other way around, it's just a parabola, so there is a stable state right here at the top, then it becomes stable and the field, the system rolls down the hill, but it can roll down in different directions, in different positions, and eventually you get a situation where there is a part of the system which gets trapped here because it just cannot roll down in any particular direction without actually breaking the system, and that's that effect. I have to make a small dictionary so that we can understand each other. I mean, well, this is very familiar, but let me introduce the notation. The phase transition is going to occur when the system is cooled from a high temperature to a low temperature, and the boundary is the critical temperature Tc. The state of the system is described by an order parameter, which I'm going to consider in this case is going to be just 1, n equals 1. scalar field phi in the disordered state above the phase transition, the phi vanishes below the phase transition, it takes a non-zero value, to a region where phi has a well-defined value, a highly correlated value, constitutes a domain. The typical size of the domain is the correlation length, psi. This is one of the important concepts in the whole thing, the correlation length, the distances over to which the order parameter is well, is highly correlated. The second important concept is the relaxation time tau. The system, it's not really the time in which the system comes to equilibrium, but it is rather the time in which the system can effectively answer to an external perturbation. And what is important is that as we approach a phase transition, the response time tau and the correlation length psi has a simple dependence as functions of the reduced temperature TR. They just go as power loss, with this nu and mu being the critical exponents. I mean, there are some critical exponents, there are more critical exponents, but these two are the only ones I'm going to need. And to make it even more precise, essentially when I say the critical exponent is going to be nu, when I want to say mu, I'm going to say the dynamical critical exponent. So this is essentially the response, and this is the correlation length.
What is this concept of domain exactly? You have a spontaneously broken phase, or what is your picture? I mean, the correlation, you know, the normally, a domain is when you have a spontaneously broken phase. Right?
Okay, in the end, psi is going.
They are not at all given by the correlation.
Now, this is just a qualitative picture. In the end, psi is going to be the inverse of a second derivative of a correlation function at the origin. Okay, that's part of the discussion. Hold that question, because that's the last point in the talk. Okay. All those problems. I mentioned that there was a traditional way of solving the problem, so let me just mention it very briefly, which was both based in the concept of the Ginzburg temperature. And the idea is that when the temperature was below the critical point, when the temperature is low enough, I just don't have enough energy to jump this potential well from one stable vacuum to another, so there the defects are really frozen in position. So if I'm above this temperature, then I can, by thermal activation, and can make and unmake defects. So really, this will be the point in which it really makes sense to talk about defects. This is the way people used to think about this. I wouldn't particularly agree with that last statement.
What is the physical process and time you are considering? Is this slowly changing temperature?
Yes. Until the end of the talk, it's going to be slowly changing temperature. But I'm going to be very precise about what is the physical. When I get to the simulation, it's going to be everything very precise. So the idea was that, well, if one wanted to know how many defects were formed, then the idea was that there was one defect per domain measured at the Ginzburg temperature, and that gave a number. Now, the problem was that in many systems, the Ginzburg temperature is actually below the critical temperature, but not much below, so actually the correlation length there is very big, and the density of defects that were coming out was very low. But, well, people say, too bad. That's life. There was something weird about that picture, and it was precisely that in that picture, the way the phase transition came about didn't have absolutely any role to play. I mean, everything that was important was what is the equilibrium correlation length at the Ginsburg temperature. How I got at the Ginsburg temperature just didn't enter into formalism. And that's the point that Zurek in 85 say, well, listen, here there's something missing. So he made this other proposal, and the way he did it, this thing in blue actually applies to the original proposal. That is, he wasn't trying to get the actual number of defects, but he was trying to see how the density would scale with some parameter characterizing the non-equilibrium aspect, characterizing the rate at which the system was being cooled down. I was told by Greg, actually, that now this blue paragraph is a little outdated. Now some people claim that they can actually derive the actual number of defects and not just the scaling law. But I'm only going to talk about the original proposal, and the original proposal is only a scaling proposal. I mean, how does this scale with some parameter which is going to be essentially the rate of the cooling down? And the proposal is this transparency, which I wouldn't be able to explain in some other way than this. Actually, this argument is not by Zurek, but by Rivers, but I find it clearer than the original Zurek's argument. So suppose that the system is being cooled down, and as it's cooled down, because of this critical slowing down, the response time is getting larger and larger. So at some point, and also these domains are growing. And the speed of sound in the system is order of magnitude, the correlation length divided the response time. It gets to a point where the domains are growing faster than the speed of sound. And at that point, the system gets dynamically decoupled from the environment which is creating the, which is making the cooling down. So, from that point on, the evolution is ballistic. I mean, until that point, the system was following a certain environment. And after that point, the system is on its own. So it's going to create effects, but it's going to have a scale print on it. And that scale is the correlation length at the last time the system and the environment talk to each other. So from then on, the process is going to be very complex and nonlinear and whatever, but it's going to be determined by this scale, which is the last time system and environment were efficiently coupled. And when one makes that into numbers, one gets a scaling law. One defines a cooling rate by claiming that close enough to the phase transition, the reduced temperature is just linear in time with some slope. And then one finds that the correlation length at the time of freeze out, the time where the system and environment get decoupled, the correlation length at the time of freeze out, which is going to be this scale, scales with the quench rate as an exponent, which is just this combination of the critical exponent and the dynamical exponent. So, well, two comments. When I say that our results support the picture, all I claim is that our results support that this scaling law is correct. I'm not going to say anything about the words that go with the picture. If one likes it, fine. If one doesn't like it, it's okay. But the point is that the scaling law seems to be okay.
Can I have a question about the work itself? Why speed of sound?
Yeah.
Why deal with how it goes to the sound?
That's dimensional analysis. I don't think there is any other answer.
If you're in a cosmological setting, isn't the effect of sound speed supposed to use actually the speed of light effect, causality,
bound on the main road?
I wasn't really spend too much time on this. I mean, this is just words that allow you to suggest that there is a scaling law like this. We're going to check the scaling law. The scaling law works. And it's not trivial because it is not obvious that you have to make this particular combination of exponents. You could do anything else. So I think there is content. It's not zero content. Yes? Well, that's one of the reasons for going to cosmology, because then it's going to be clear. The expansion of the universe is going to be cooling down the environment. But
yeah,
we're going to see.
No, but I mean, you're assuming there's some environment which always has a definite temperature.
Right?
And then there's a system that...
Okay, let's hold that kind of question, hold it until I can show you what the model is. You're going to see that the model is well-defined.
Okay, but a quick question. Are you going to do a space or not?
I'm going to put a scalar field into an expanding universe, and expanding universe is going to cool it down. So it will quench.
But you said you're going to do this in some slowness? No, there's no slowness approximation.
Well, there's going to be a Hubble parameter, and depending what the Hubble parameter is...
The cooling speed is irrelevant in your formalism, right?
Well, you're going to see that it's not.
No, I mean, your formalism works for all cooling rates, or does it only work for slow cooling rates, or what?
No, there are two different regimes. In one regime, the cooling dominates, so essentially you have slow rolling down, and then you have a set of exponents, and there's another regime in which the wave aspect dominates, and then you have another set of exponents, and you can see both the regimes, both regimes.
Just setting up a quantum field and watching it evolve.
No, no, no. Are we
talking about second order transitions?
Pardon?
Second.
Yes. So, I mentioned that there were attempts to experimentally prove the thing, and they are promising, at least I have to say something. The published experiment seems to agree with the proposal. But there is a paper by Rivers in which he claims that there are unpublished experiments that don't agree. Now, they have been published now? Okay, fine. So then I have to say published before October 98?
Even the interpretation of a published experiment is not particularly straightforward.
Okay, then we agree. Okay, well, as Salman says, we can scrap all this because this is not conclusive. Great, thank you. What about the numerical studies? I think the numerical situation is much better. But still, I would argue that we are not there yet. And I don't want to offend anybody. But I think it's fair to say that the simulations I know of, well, at the beginning, they were relying on time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau equations, which you are not sure is really a good description of the dynamics close to the critical point. Or they were putting a noise by hand, and it wasn't... Sure.
Why do you say that? Because it's a second-order phase transition. There's critical slowing down. And so if the rates are not too fast, the CDGL, because it gives you the right dynamics of exponents, ought to be reasonable.
Well, okay, so tell that to experimentalists.
They don't understand anything.
Now, then there is this point, which I think gets closer to what Dr. Lori was saying, which is, I mean, you have to say what the system is, what the environment is, you have to say how you're going to cool the thing. It's not irrelevant. It's not that there is some parameter T in the equation, so you're going to put this time dependent. You have to be a little more precise about that. And then even the really good simulations, the best simulations at hand, are really classical. So there is still the question of what's going to happen in a fully quantum simulation. So I think there, although there is very good work done and being done, it is fair to say that as with experimental tests, we may conclude that the results are promising, but they are not conclusive. And that's where we begin. what's our proposal? Our model is a model of creation of domain walls in an expanding universe, and I have to emphasize this. This model is not cosmologically realistic. We are not doing cosmology. We are just setting up a model that we can solve that will allow us to check a particular scaling law. So our proposal is to test the validity of the Frisell's hypothesis in a model of a phase transition leading to the formation of domain walls in an expanding universe, just a single real scalar field with a lambda phi fourth inverted potential. The model certainly is not cosmologically realistic. We know there are no domain walls out there, but it has several advantages over other strategies, such as it's fully relativistic.
That depends on the energy density of the domain walls.
Pardon?
That depends on the energy density.
Okay. But the point is, we are not really trying to do cosmology. We are trying just to have a model that we can solve. The model is fully relativistic, it's fully quantum. The model is simple enough to be developed from first principles.
What do you mean fully quantum?
Pardon?
What do you mean fully quantum? Okay, what?
It's fully quantum. Okay. It's like quantum field theory. We're not going to do semi-classical approximation.
Come on,
It can be developed from first principles with well understood approximations, and the Kulin mechanism is there explicitly. The Kulin mechanism, expansion of the universe, it cools the system by the principle of equivalence. So there is absolutely no question that that is the right way of putting into the equations. There is no approximation concerning how we cool it. And although this model is not cosmologically relevant, that doesn't mean that phase transitions are not cosmologically relevant. So one could think of this as a first step into building models of cosmological phase transitions that really would be interesting. So the model is a single real scalar field with an effective potential given by it's not a Mexican hat because it's just one dimension, just an inverted. It leads an especially flat, radiation-dominated Friedmann-Robertson-Walker. This is going to be a test field. Recall, I'm not doing cosmology. This is a test field. So we could choose any expansion of the universe we like. We just choose radiation-dominated because it's simple to handle. It leads a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker model expanding as A of t is equal to this. See, here is your quench rate, because the Hubble parameter is essentially 1 over TQ. So this TQ is going to tell you whether you are going fast or you are going slow. And there are other scales in the theory, because you have this mass here, and you also have a wavelength. So it makes sense to say whether the quench is fast or small. There are other scales in the theory. In the early stages of the phase transition, the field distribution is Gaussian. I don't think anybody would quarrel with that, but anyway, I'm going to go back to that anyway at the end. If the field distribution is Gaussian, then there is a theorem that relates the density of zeros of the fields to the two-point function. So this formula here is a theorem. And for all practical purposes, we could say that this ratio is the definition of 1 over xi squared. So really, there is no ambiguity about what xi is.
Is there a linear density of field
cells? Pardon? Now,
who cares about field?
Pardon?
Why should we care about field
zero? Well, that's a good question. I mean, if there is a wall, there is a field zero inside. The issue is whether you have a field zero or whether you have a wall.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, that's the issue I'm going to discuss at the end. Okay, let me...
His correlation function is actually the domain size, not the microscopic correlation length.
How do you know that?
Okay, let me keep going, but that's an important question. It's not something that we disregard. So it's going to come up at several stages, and let me discuss it.
Before
as it's showing up.
You're perfectly free to consider this quantity, but in a quantum theory, those mode integrals are generally divergent. Right? Are you going to worry about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But essentially, we're.
In fact, not well defined, as it stands.
Yeah, but essentially we are going to, I mean, the answer is not going to be, but let me get to the answer when I get there.
But you don't care about the field.
Exactly.
It's ultraviolet.
Yeah, it's all UV.
Okay.
And just to be precise, to say that in United States, the distribution, the field distribution is Gaussian.
Pardon?
When exactly do you mean that the distribution is Gaussian? Are you considering the
uniform? This is an early time simulation, an early as early. We are just trying to see whether the scaling law is helpful to set up the initial conditions for the defect network.
Here. You're saying what spectrum is in it, what the field theory is, what the distribution of the field is at a certain point. Is
yeah.
Say early stages of this solution. What do you mean by that? Early compared to what? Is it high temperatures? Is it the critical domain?
Okay, we are going to get to that. So there is this theorem that relates the density of zeros in the field to the two-point function. The two-point function is just the ordinary two-point function. It has a Fourier transform. The Fourier transform in the Gaussian approximation can be written in terms of mode functions with some thermal factors. This beta is, I mean, I'm beginning in a thermal state built on the adiabatic particle model at times t equals zero. So this beta is 1 over the temperature of that initial state. And, well, Wk is the energy in the adiabatic particle model. And this is the engine, this is the core of the model. The modes solve, well, the Klein-Gordon equation with a self-consistent mass which has to be found self-consistently. In this equation where altering normalization has already been done, and with initial conditions, which are just the initial conditions for the adiabatic particle model at times t equals zero. When I mean that the renormalization has already been done, I just mean that the bare parameters appearing in the potential, the MB and the lambda B, has to be substituted by renormalized parameters, lambda R and MR, and I just wrote down the formulas. Since this is a test field, I don't have to worry about mu nu conservation. I don't know if you check it, but it wouldn't make any difference because it's simply a test field.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a really strange statement. It doesn't matter if it's a test field. That's a very
conservative
field.
Yeah.
No, but if the stress tension is dominated by a whole bunch of other fields in the early universe, then if it's...
Oh, come on, what is it?
Do you have a Lagrangian for this theory? The stress tension should be conservative. There's nothing, no words need to be said.
Yeah, I mean, even if it's not conserved exactly, it's not going to make a big difference in the final answer.
So.
I thought you said that you were going to do this exactly.
Pardon? Sorry, I
thought you said that you were going to do this dynamics exactly.
Well, I mean, the point is that I'm just. Okay. When you solve the model...
So this is the hard approximation.
When you solve the model, what you find is that the effective mass is going like this. So this is the plot of the effective mass versus cosmological time, and the correlation length is just 1 over that. So... You see, so the effective mass becomes...
That's true, the defects are non-Gaussian, but the scales that you see in the early stages of the phase transition, which actually aren't defects yet, but will turn into defects if you could evolve the system for late time, you can see in the Gaussian approximation.
So you actually see the actual defect?
No.
So that begs again the question I asked you before. You start with the Gaussian initial condition.
Right. Yes.
Where are you?
He started from the thermal state.
The adiabatic particle move.
It's a galaxy by definition, right?
It's high temperature. But it's high temperature, and from then on, we're just solving the equations.
Given that it's high temperature, and treating this quantum mechanically completely irrelevant.
Well, it's not going to stay high temperature. I mean, it starts with a positive effective mass, then it cools down. Eventually, the effective mass gets negative. If you keep going into simulation, I emphasize the if. You will see the effective, you will see that there is an infrared peak, and then the effective mass begins to grow again, and eventually it becomes positive again. So what I mean by early in the simulation, I mean we're going to look at this period of time, essentially around here. This is the first time where the fluctuations get really large, so this is the first time where the issue about non-linearities, non-Gaussian effects really becomes important. We are just going to stop around here, so really that issue is not going to appear. And in this issue, in this regime, where Hartree, or if you want to call it large N, leading 1 over N, is perfectly good and controlled, and there's lots of experience about that.
Actually, at that point, before the curve comes up again, you might as well be free. You might as well be free here.
Sure.
Because you got exactly, it's a very good approximation.
Right.
There's no back reaction.
Right.
At that point.
Sure. Why does it go up again? Maybe I need to see something. Sure. Why does it
Give me a second, I'll answer that.
Is that the mass or mass squared?
You see? When you look at the spectrum, this is k squared times the Fourier transform of the two-point function. What you see is that an infrared peak develops, and it develops really fast. It's exponential. So essentially, the fact that the effective mass goes up again is that you're beginning to feel the effects of this condensate. And that also takes care of the issue about the ultraviolet dependence of this ratio, the integral of k squared g over the integral of g. I mean, it is true that if you just look at it, you have a strong contribution from this region, but this is universal and have nothing to do with the phase transition. So we are perfectly free just to do the calculation, to cut it off, and to see what is the effect of the condensate, what is the effect of the infrared peak, and this is meaningful information. So in that integral, essentially the part that really matters, and we are not the only ones saying this, I mean Rivers is saying almost exactly the same words. What you really have to see is what is the contribution from the condensate, and that is what is going to define your density of zeros. And that begs the question of how you go from zeros to defects. Yes. But we didn't get it out by hand. I mean, that's the point. We didn't cross it out. I mean, maybe it doesn't appear. Okay. But that's physics. It's not our fault.
The high momentum part is universal,
that's what we say, that's what everyone said, I guess,
and this makes the problem classical.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, that.
Okay. The point is that
we didn't assume it from the outset. Nobody does. You look at the power spectra, that contains a small momentum, and the large momentum part is universal, so it's classical. If it doesn't, you don't.
So...
Although your physical picture, no one is going to argue with, I do think it's an important technical point that definition of zeros is highly divergent. I mean, it's highly cut off the fact, quadratically. And you may say you're going to only look at the infrared effects, and maybe it's reasonable to put a cutoff here, but if I decide to put it at twice that, I will get an answer which is four times different.
Okay.
So how will you ever get any quantitative control of the problem this way?
Okay. The point is, we are really interested about how it is scaled. So we are not really interested in whether we are creating 10 or 100 defects. The point is, when we change the quench rate, how does that number change? So we do get a well-defined number for that.
Let me ask another question.
Yes.
To this
Suppose I'm not doing time evolution at all.
I stick you at a finite temperature and I say, please calculate the density of zeros. You can certainly calculate the density of zeros in this approximation just using finite temperature. Are you then going to stand up and say, that's the density of defect?
No, you're not. So, right? So then you say, but if things were evolving and I looked at the number of zeros changing, that somehow is going to scale the same way as the number of defects scale. That seems kind of a logical step to me.
Well, okay. I'm going to make it, but I'm going to tell you why.
Why?
I'm going to tell you. Wait. Have patience.
Why are you
going to? As I was saying,
that's a good question.
The problem has two well-defined regimes. There is what we call the... Because you have the second derivative and you have the first derivative, so you have the regime where the first derivative dominates, which is for the fast quenches, and you have the regime where the second derivative dominates. So you have the overdamped regime where the first derivative is the dominant, and you have the underdamped regime when the second derivative is the dominant. And each regime has its own set of exponents. So these are the results for the this is the underdamp regime. And you see, I mean, the log of K max. So K max is the center of the peak. That because the peak is essentially a Gaussian, when you do the integral, that's essentially all you're picking up is the contribution from this center. So K max is this center here. And this is the plot of the log of K max against the log of this quench, this say tau here because this is Gregg's notation. And you can see that there is a scaling law coming out quite clearly. In the other regime, it also works. In the other regime, in the overdamp, regime also, the scaling law is pretty obvious. That there is a scaling law.
Yes.
K max is essentially 1 over psi. And the way we measure it is just where is the center of that exponential peak in the structure function.
Okay. Because the way you set it up, physics is, you know,
yeah.
You might have done everything by hand.
Pardon?
You might have done everything by hand. You just have to know.
Yes, we just didn't. We were honest and serious.
And actually, it's not clear at the beginning that when the back reaction sets in, this picture doesn't change. You're right around, just around the
critical
point.
Point.
We measured the peak at different times. One in the linear regime and one with back reaction had a chance to set in. The answers are the same. I'm not sure which.
I think these were the other results, but since it didn't change.
The exponents don't change. The scale doesn't change. The so back reaction doesn't have an effect, but you don't know that at the beginning, a priori.
This is actually kind of a strange statement. If classical theory is more or less valid for this thing, then I don't have to make your Gaussian approximation. I can go directly to the computer and, as Luis and other people have done, run a time-dependent Landau Ginzburg simulation.
Yeah, but this is actually...
Wait. No, that automatically has back reaction and all effects because you're solving the right classical theory already.
So you are approximating
something which you don't need to approximate.
I get the same law, and I do this on my PC at home because
you can do
it by hand.
You don't need to even do this if you want.
Okay, so then this afternoon in the discussion session we're going to hear.
We did it by hand.
What is that number? 10 by.
Okay, this is the next transparency. What I want to say here, I mean, the numerical data say that there are clearly two regimes. It was sort of surprising that there is essentially two. The transition is quite sharp from one regime to the other. And in each regime, there is a well-defined exponent. So far, so good.
Excuse me, are you saying the back reaction has no effect on those exponents?
Which, what do you mean by back reaction? Back reaction of what on what? The back reaction, you mean the back reaction of the fluctuations? And the equation for the mode functions was self-consistent, because the equation for the mode functions, I'm sorry that I have a mess here. It's not going to be easy to find.
So reaction means time when your mode is no longer in the linear.
That's right.
So you can see simply. You do have it for some reason, but in classical problem you don't have to do that.
Okay, then we had to define what back reaction was.
Okay, but you see that there is back reaction because our effective mass is strongly time dependent. I mean, the fact that the effective mass is just jumping up and down is precisely because of the back reaction. It's not that we are not taking it into account. We have not taken into account what will be the scattering of these created particles, but we can do that because we are in this regime where the scattering is not really important. So I don't say that we are solving exactly quantum field theory. What I say is that our approximations are controlled. We know they work. In the sense that we know they work. I mean, if I were making statements around here, then I would say, well, okay, these guys are crazy. They are not taking into account all the effects which have to do with thermalization and scattering. But we are up here. And here, that kind of the set in sun graph, all those two loops effects, are not really important.
But Harvey back reaction is important.
And it is taken into account. It is there.
Why do you think that scattering is not important? Why do you think that?
Because we are just seeing what is, in the terms of the picture that...
Excuse me, it's a good thing with scattering and without, and compare.
Okay, but in the picture you drew yesterday, we are here. We are not yet to the point where we get there. And we don't care about that regime. This is enough for us.
Sometimes scattering becomes important, and this, I believe, it's very likely to happen in that model. Sometimes scattering becomes important no later than the Hartree shifting frequency.
It depends very much also on your chosen initial condition. In other words, if you get to that point, C equals 4 with a lot of land.
But I want to say there is no reason to believe in general that you first have a shift in frequency coming in and then scattering. Sometimes it happens that way, but sometimes it doesn't.
Okay.
So just to rephrase that, you're saying that the difference between using Hartree and just straight one-loop perturbation theory is significant?
Yes, because the effect on the mass is really important. You can see that the mass is changing by orders of magnitude.
But as soon as that's true, what you're saying is you really have an uncontrolled approximation.
Absolutely.
There's certainly no small parameters that is telling you that corrections to Hartree are smaller than the difference between Hartree and just straight perturbation.
Okay, but we could have done 1 over n, and the result would have been the same.
The scaling results don't depend on whether you're doing free field or Hartree or one loop. Because it's all early time dynamic.
No, but the point I get is the
effect anyway.
Right, I mean, take the
But that's never been the argument. The argument has always been, what the hell are we calculating?
Okay, we are calculating these two numbers. So the result so far is that there is a scaling. And we have a numerical result for what exponent is in each region. So far, so good. There is scaling. The quench rate is certainly playing a role concerning the density of zeros. But that's not all we're saying. I mean, the Friis-Haut conjecture doesn't just say that there is scaling. It makes a definite prediction about what the rate should be. The exponent should be this alpha, which is a ratio of the critical exponent and the dynamical critical exponent. So the next issue is, we have to compute them for our model and see whether it matches. Now, to do that, we have to solve the gap equation, which for a finite cutoff is certainly hard to do. But since we have checked...
What is kappa in the law?
Pardon?
What is the kappa in the law?
Where is the kappa? Oh, this is just a cutoff scale, an infrared cutoff.
Infrared.
But this term really, it doesn't really play any role in what I'm talking about. I was saying, we have to solve the gap equation, which in general is going to be very hard, but since we are in a regime where we already check numerically that we had cutoff independence, to get the gap equation we can take the cutoff to infinity. And for critical exponents, all you care about is the regime in which the effective mass is very small, so you can make the approximation that the physical mass is small. And in those two approximations, you get a gap equation that you can solve. And then, if you ask what the critical exponent is, well, the textbook definition of the critical exponent for this model will be nu equals 1. But that's not really what you care about, because essentially what you have here, I mean, it is clear, okay, you can solve this. And when you do that, what you find is that the physical mass is not a single simple power. This is a plot of the log of the physical mass against the log of the reduced temperature, not time. This is reduced temperature. And the solution is this line. It comes here and it's the blue line below. You can see it's not just a simple power, but you can define an effective critical exponent in this regime will be 0.68, in this regime will be in this regime is just 0.57, in this regime is just 0.68. So you don't have one critical exponent, but you can define an effective critical exponent that will describe the behavior of the physical mass against reduced temperature in the different regime. Yes.
Yeah. And they're not. Pardon? Yeah. There's a problem with Hartree because then it's no longer.
I mean, I'm solving for the exponent with an accuracy which is comparable with the accuracy which is already in the model. It wouldn't make sense to go and measure these exponents experimentally, because we need exponents that will be commensurate with the physics which we put into the model at the beginning.
I just find the aim of this minute is very narrow. In Hartree, the second order phase transition actually becomes first order. Does that bother you?
Well, it didn't bother it. I mean,
why should that matter in a dynamical sense?
If you're wrong at high temperature, you ought to be wrong in that when you're evolving with the first time. Don't you think so?
You see, the whole philosophy is we're being serious and honest. With this type of model, we are using approximations which are well known and going through it. We're going to see what number we get in the end.
Completely uncontrolled approximation.
We just want to be wrong.
N equals 1 is not something you trust.
Okay.
Well, wait, that's something you can trust on some at some time scale. Certainly for some time scale,
something
not
you can
ever.
Trust whenever it significantly differs from one loop perception.
Exactly.
But you don't have to go. Remember that we are making a statement about what was going on at the time where the infrared peak begins to grow. We don't have to go to late or near late or early late regime. This is early regime. And in this regime, things work.
Does that mean we get essentially the same results if we simply model this as an upside down harmonic oscillator?
Maybe, but the problem, the issue is we didn't ask that question. We just put the model there and asked what the model is telling us. We didn't try to be clever. We tried to be honest.
What if being honest in an approximation that doesn't work? That is what I'm trying to
do. So,
what the temperature that
you put in the formula that you've taken off? Oh, we are just assuming that temperature is initial temperature over that E is scales with T over A. But you can actually check, I don't have that particular plot in here. But if you check what will be your thermal mass minus m bar square plus t square over 24 with t going like 1 over a, you plot that against the actual effective mass, and in the regime we are working it matches pretty well. So It is true that it will go like 1 over A only for radiation. It is not a conformal model. But you are in a regime where really the difference doesn't have time to build up. And it works pretty well. We check that. So, I was saying, we have the numerical results. We have to get point... No, sorry, this is the theoretical. We have the numerical results. We have the definition of this effective exponent, the derivative of the log of m against the log of the reduced temperature. And when you plot that, you get in the under-damp regime, the red will be the theoretical prediction. This one is the numerical result. In the over-damp regime, the blue is the theoretical prediction. This is the numerical result. So it is matching in a 10% here easily, and it's matching within a 5% there also easily. No.
That's actually something we didn't compute just because we didn't think that the results were robust enough to justify error bars. I mean,
well, that's just what I want to get a sense of. So I'll phrase it as saying, suppose I just used the mean field exponent. Then instead of 0.27, I predict a quarter.
Yes.
So is the difference between your 0.28 and 0.25 something that I should pay any attention to?
No.
I mean, what was significant for us is that you were moving in the right direction. That a better calculation of the exponents gave you a better fit. And we were happy with that. I mean, there is an issue here. What are we really trying to get out of this? I mean, this is an scaling result based on something which is little more than dimensional analysis.
But that's why it's so good.
Yes, and it's extremely good. That's the whole point of the talk.
That simple argument of Zurek is actually a very good argument.
Yes.
My view, there's no point trying to bolster it by,
Well, I mean, there is a point making it in a case in which you can actually do both, and that just bolsters your confidence, and now you can use it in cases in which you really won't go through the trouble of actually doing... you want to use it and do cosmology. And this is saying, okay, go ahead. I mean, within a 5%, you're fine. And to get the initial conditions for the string network. I mean, these defects then are going to evolve non-linearly, they are going to scatter each other, they are going to emit gravitational radiation whatsoever.
But I haven't seen any defects yet.
Okay.
There aren't any at this stage. I mean, all you're seeing is a particular scale that shows up in the low wavelength, in the long wavelength mode at the early stages of the phase transition. If you do a classical field theory where you can actually follow the full dynamic, you see the same picture at early times, and that scale goes over to the scale that sets the defect density. You can actually see it.
Wait,
but in a quantum field theory, you can't. Nobody knows how it evolved for those late times. But you see the same picture.
When we did what you described for a different model, though, and we saw strings actually, one of the results that comes out that at early stages there are very many what we call small strings,
which are zeros of the field, right?
And there's a soup of those things. At the later times, they collapse or annihilate, and sometimes you will have many of those small strings initially, but not a single one big string in the end.
Sure. So that's the whole point. The early analysis of zeros is completely misleading when you're actually trying to...
It doesn't tell you what necessarily the final...
It's not misleading. It's just giving you what initial condition is. I mean, it is important to know what initial condition is, otherwise you can't begin.
There's some of the correlation line, which is limited by your rate of cool.
Basically.
This is as far as we got with this model. But it so happened that at the same time, a student of mine, David Vasita, was working and studying an instantaneous quench in a model for a type 2 superconductor. So these are just the Gorkov equations for type 2 superconductor. These delta is the order parameter and it's coupled to an abelian field, it's two dimensions, the defects are going to be vortices, and this Maxwell field obeys an equation which is essentially the Maxwell's equations with the London current, and it's a type 2 superconductor because we wanted to have defects. So this regime, of course, is very different. This model is perfectly classical. It's only two-dimensional. It has an interesting non-linearity. It has only one regime. This model is overdamped by definition. So here we're only working in the overdamped regime. And what he did is to put these equations on a lattice and to solve them. So you can actually look at defects by just taking a plaquette, seeing what the phase of the order parameter is doing, and seeing how many defects are there inside the plaquette. And you can do this Liu and Masenko song and dance, compute the spectrum, get that integral of k squared g, compute that ratio, whatever. What the spectrum is doing, by the way, extremely interesting. This is the plot of what the spectrum is doing. And what he did here is just to take a picture, to take pictures of this lattice at different times, make the first Fourier transform of the spectrum and compute GK. And this is the log of GK. When I showed the other picture with a hump, there was a K square in front. There is no K square here. It's a picture of the log of the two-point function against k square. And at the beginning, you have this exponent, this Gaussian peak developing here. And a straight line here means that the two-point function goes like e to the minus c square k square. And at some point, t equals zero is here, you see that, well, you have this infrared peak, and then the ultraviolet begins to grow again. And it makes sense because, okay, so we are creating vortices.
Can you remember this person who did that?
Pardon?
Who did that?
Who?
What person did that?
David. a student of mine in Buenos Aires, David Ibaceta, so we did it together.
Did he or she try to plot this on log scale? Is there a
power law, in other words? Here? Yes. Well, here what you're seeing is essentially...
Before we lose that, would you just explain again which... I mean, as time increases, I've got curves all over the place.
This is early time, not so early time, not so early time. T equals zero, positive time.
Starting at negative time.
Right. Yes. Yeah, well, you're going to see in next picture why. So essentially what's happening is you start with some, it was a thermal distribution, I think, but there wasn't much power anywhere. You have this spinola instability, it goes up explosively, and then you see that the ultraviolet begins to grow. And what this shape is perfectly clear. That shape is the Fourier transform of this thing, which is just an Avdikosov-Gorkov vortex. Mm-hmm. So it's perfectly clear what it is. It is exactly what it has to be. It's just the Fourier transform of a vortex with some modulation because you have many vortexes there. And so having explained that, I mean, I want to emphasize that the early behavior of this model is exactly the same that we saw in the other model.
A vortex is a field, phi of whatever is the matter, phi of x.
Yes.
You sure enough can transform it. I do not see immediate relation of that Fourier transform of the function of x to the two-point correlation function that you are plotting. Yeah, this is power spectrum. This is
I mean, we begin with random initial conditions and make an ensemble average.
No,
that's
I just
the way.
I don't see why Fourier transform of the vortex's shape
don't see that easily. How?
But well, it works. It works in, I mean, you are beginning to see this in the regime where you have few vortices in the lattice and they are widely separated.
Everyone is saying to me,
well, we can see it later. It works.
But is it just one time?
Is it a huge
They are very dense, the few, first few numerical iterations, and then they decay, and you have very few separated vortices.
Then there are 10, the time to minus 50. What time will they dense?
Oh, no. They will be dense far over here. And then, I mean, you launch a thing, you have thousands of defects, and a few iteration times, you have tens, and then you keep having tens, going down slowly for a long time. No.
I was asking, it's sort of this, that we usually think of topological defects as being non-Gaussian for shape.
Yes.
And the power spectrum is a two-point correlation function.
Yes.
So when you can see non-Gaussian things in the sort of Gaussian favorite quantity, which is...
This simulation is not Gaussian. We just took the equations and solved them.
Just talking about Fourier integrals. Forget simulation. Simulation is fine. Complete nonlinear simulation.
Yes.
I love those.
Okay. What we plot here, see, this is the expectation value of delta was the order parameter. So this is the expectation value of delta to the fourth over delta squared squared. For a Gaussian distribution, this is just, you make an integration by parts, this thing is 2 for a Gaussian distribution. And this is the plot of what it actually is in the simulation. So you can see that indeed it is Gaussian up to a times of 10 to the minus 20. And then it's no longer Gaussian. And that's it. It's no longer Gaussian. That's life.
Yes.
So we are not saying anything about Gaussian here.
Right. That's not the question.
This is what the order parameter is doing. You see, well, it sits around the unstable vacuum for a while, and it sometimes says, gee, I'm in the stable vacuum. So it begins to roll down, and it rolls down. We put just t equals 0 is the half time. It's the, we set t equals 0 when the mean field wasn't halfway down. And this is the important thing. This is the ratio of the number of defects predicted by the Liu and Mazinko formula of SK squared G over G, whatever, over the number of defects that you get by just counting how many real defects you have in any plaquette, at every plaquette. Well, we discussed that in Brookhaven. Yes.
So you're saying a single, I mean, you're really counting zeros, so to speak.
I'm seeing what the circulation of the phase is at every plaquette and then adding them.
So if you simply had a highly disordered configuration, you'd describe that as having a very, very large number of...
Yes, only that in the case, you're not going to see it in this plot because in a few iterations times over here it will decay. It's a pity that I don't have that plot here because we did that. And you see that at the beginning, okay, you get some very noisy signal, but it lasts 2 or 3 iteration times, and then it goes away. And the point is, well, this is the ratio between this defect number generated by this formula we have some right to be unhappy about, over some definition of defects that most people will be happy about. And you can see that up to a time t equals 0, remember that at time t equals 0, in this particular simulation, t equals 0 is rather late. Because in t equals 0, you already have some significant power into ultraviolet. It wasn't just the infrared hump. So at a time t equals 0, it works pretty well. I mean, it works extremely well at minus 10. At time t equals 0, order of magnitude is certainly working very well. So when I saw this, I said, well, okay, I mean, in principle, you are right. If I wanted to carry the simulation over here, then I would say, you are absolutely right. But we are working here. And here, I think we have a right to use that formula. And we can, we have a right to say that although what we computed was a density of zeros, the density of defects shouldn't be too far off. So again, as a scaling argument that you are going to use just to get an initial condition for the string network that then you're going to evolve with some more sophisticated approach. And taking into account the investment that you have to put in to get the numbers out is beautiful. And that's the conclusion of the talk. Thank you. Pardon?
If you have get four vectors, strings, they would form.
It's two dimensions, much later.
This is two dimensions. We didn't go to three. We are planning to.
So you attribute this the deviation from electron of the sum from one to the fact that the theory is not bouncing.
Essentially, yes. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to apply the formula because the formula is a theorem based on the assumption that the distribution is Gaussian. And here, clearly, it's no longer Gaussian, so you shouldn't do it. And you do it, you get garbage, okay?
Returning to direct mechanism. I think what you observed here is that the something quite different from what you say. So what you observe is that you have finite decomposition, and whatever defect form after the phase transition already happened, right? Well,
yeah, I mean,
by order the decomposition when t is smaller than tc.
Yes.
What Durek said is that, well, you approach t from above, at some point the correlation blends, the critical slowing down so big, so that you have reached a place where the field is
inhomogeneous. Yeah, I don't want to get involved into a discussion of what Zurich said because I personally don't understand it myself. All I'm claiming is that somehow he managed to identify a scale which is relevant to the problem.
Let me continue my thought. And the two scales are the same because the cooling rate is the same above and below the TC. So what I think is, if you did the simulation when the cooling rate is different from the two regimes, then you should have seen deviation from the rate formula. Maybe
let's say
physical situation, but
when we began this project,
identify where the defect forms above or below TC.
And this is a very personal statement, but when we began this project, we were extremely skeptical about the Friis-Haut conjecture. Because we said, well, okay, this is order of magnitude. In the original paper, Zurich was essentially just doing time-dependent Landau and Ginzburg. We said, well, clearly it was a problem, but there was a single scale, so it wasn't that difficult to get that one scale. So we said, well, okay, if you put this into a more complete model, then it cannot possibly work. And it beat us. So now I'm going to say, well, he beat me. I mean, it works. And I'm happy with that. I'm not trying to understand it beyond the fact that here there is a scale, which I personally prefer to understand it in the terms that Rivers describes it. Well, look when the speed of sound is not high enough that you can match the growth of domains. That's a scale which is significant to the problem.
Because maybe
Zurich
identifying some mechanism
instead
accidentally
gives
you the right
well,
answer.
Better for him. I mean, this show that it's not just an accident.
But what we're talking about is the problem.
My main problem is versus defect. There's a big difference, conceivably, potentially, not necessarily, but likely, between 2D and 3D. The 2D systems are easily distorted, can be easily disordered by defect. So if you do the simulation, then even at late times in 2D, I suppose you find a whole soup of defects, or zeros, or what you call them. 3D simulations with strings look entirely different. And as I said, there are many, many small strings initially, but the 3D system is not as easily disordered, And when it sort of relaxes, you only have big strings eventually. Small strings disappear, and the number of the initial small strings, or zeros, does not seem to be in any relation to the number of large strings. You can have very similar looking suits at early stages, and in one case you will get large strings, and in another case you won't.
Okay, well, I'll say it's a point.
2D versus 3D is important here, because
okay.
Disorder is different.
Okay.
But what really counts, according to his argument, are the correlations of the large scale. That's what we're talking about here is the universality properties of the critical domain as a second order picture vision. And those apply over large scale and not over a tiny scale. And so what you're talking about, what the density of strings that you have to measure to see the direct scale is really something to do with the large scale.
Well, if you measure zeros
if you measure zeros, you got everything.
If you measure zeros at late times, those are likely to be strings.
Yeah.
Zeros at early times are likely to be just
garbage. Yeah. Noise.
Things to do with the system.
Going to leave that one, which is Peter.
I have a proposal. We have discussed the Gurek hypothesis or postulate. And under what circumstances would they not hold? Grant, maybe you can give us a summary of it.
The summary of
it. I'm looking at under what conditions we might hope to see some difference.
Well, certainly in these helium experiments that they claim they have seen nothing, but I don't know. Have you read that paper in any detail?
I don't mean experimentally.
What is your assessment?
There are many sources of uncertainty.
Okay.
Are you ever going to talk to
No.
Oh, and there's one. There's one more issue that we haven't talked about, which is although Zurek may work for setting a length scale at early times in the phase transition, if this is a very nonlinear system, and if there's a lot of energy that's stuck in the system at these early times, then it's not at all clear that whatever distribution you have at early times has any bearing whatsoever, even in a scaling way, on the distribution at late times. So if you did a different sort of situation where we looked at, say, classical field theory, but at very high initial temperatures, and then did the quench, it's likely, in fact, Luis has shown in one dimension that you see these sort of bounces of defects. That is, you have sort of well-formed defects or kinks at early times, and then there's some nonlinear processes that cause them to bounce, the density to bounce way up and not to relax back down again. And it certainly depends
on the theory.
So it depends very strongly on the initial conditions. And the initial conditions, the initial spectrum that's shown in most of the numerical experiments that have confirmed the Zurek scenario are designed, either intentionally or not, to guarantee that when you hit the basically one point of symmetry is effectively broken, you have very little energy to trigger back here. And in that sense, those correlations that you
But that combined with Zurek, there's no argument.
Coffee break, 10 minutes, and Ian is going to go in for the rest of the morning. We can then just have the end of the talk before lunch.